Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight number 617 for comics originally released on June 5th, 2019. Now, starting us off in DC is Young Justice number 6. This concludes the first story arc. Presumably it'll be the end of the first trade. It was a nice kind of stopping point there. And overall, I really enjoyed this, but there were a few things that annoyed me a little bit, even though, again, I enjoyed the issue.
I enjoyed it, too. I'm with you there. It was a decent issue.
I mean, there were some questions that were finally answered, and some of it is, I mean, we're six issues in, and we're just now finding out some stuff.
Yeah.
So that was a little frustrating, and one of my main annoyances with the issue is kind of pacing. But then also, there was a fair amount of exposition there, because, I mean, some of these answers were not a little overdue. There were some cases, I think, six issues overdue. And some of it was just kind of unsatisfying because it was given as exposition.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. There's a lot of stuff that's explained and maybe not the way you wanted it. But yeah, a lot just written in there but they did cover a lot. They still left some mysteries in there, something to keep you hooked. Like, I still want to know what's in that box that we've seen since issue one and you see it reappear here.
Oh, Jenny's trunk?
Yeah, the trunk of whatever it is that's making it glow.
Yeah, there was definitely kind of that Ark of the Covenant kind of a glow, and the whole point of that scene was to make us curious of what's in the box.
Exactly. So that's, I'm like, I need to know what's in this box.
I'm hoping they go with the take that, because they firmly establish she is the great-granddaughter of Jonah Hex, or at least the stuff belonged to her great-grandfather, who is presumably Jonah Hex. I don't recall if they actually spelled that part out to that level of clarity, although, I mean, kind of who else could it be?
Exactly.
But around the time of Crisis on Infinite Earths, there was a series called Hex.
Okay.
This took over from what had been the Jonah Hex series, featuring, of course, Jonah Hex, and it basically took him into the future.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And I'm thinking it would be fun if some of the stuff she has from her great-grandfather is future stuff.
That would be awesome. That would be a cool little play and a nod back to what happened in the past.
And would explain kind of like ray gun she's got on the cover.
Exactly. So, and she's one of the characters I like. I guess I could say probably, you know, one of the most likable characters here. Now, what did you think of Connor and his whole, how he just showed up? That was kind of weird, but I guess that's something, a mystery to be explained, but do you think it's weird how they show him in here, almost like a father-like figure?
It was weird. We found out how he became the father-like figure, and that answered some questions in a good way. I felt if they'd kind of misstepped, they could have precluded some characterization arcs later. When we got that splash page of, you know, 1 minute I was messing around with the goofballs at Star Lab, and da-da-da-da-da, I'm like, you know, a footnote there would have been nice.
Yes, it would have.
You know, when was the last time we saw this Connor Kent? Because honestly, I don't remember.
Yeah, I have no idea what they're talking about. I'm like, did I miss something? And I guess it happened a long time ago.
I'm thinking it actually happened at the end of one of the Teen Titans series early in the New 52.
Wow. So it's a long time ago.
That's a relative term.
True.
6-7 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, something that should deserve a footnote.
Yeah, long enough term that it deserves a footnote, but new enough term that it's not like new Teen Titans or original Titans, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Now, I mean, but it was kind of weird, like, how he just popped up here, you know, and that stuff happened. It's weird that some of the people know each other, some people don't know who they are. So there's still just a lot of mystery in this book. Even though some stuff was answered, we don't know exactly what's happening.
Well, about half the team is the kind of core group from the original Young Justice. Superboy, Robin, Wonder Girl, and Impulse. And then Amethyst had her own series pre-Crisis and stuff, but she's new to Young Justice and really hasn't been used much since like the mid-80s.
Okay.
And then Teen Lantern and Ginny Hex are just new to the series.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, actually, I take that back. I think Ginny Hex showed up in some of the Walmart stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, which I didn't get, but I am picking it up now that it's coming out through previews.
Yeah, yeah. So I haven't read any of that stuff. I've got them. But I'm curious what kind of her backstory is there. And apparently that was one of the stories that Bendis wrote, so it's canon.
Cool.
It just wasn't available to all of us at the direct market stores.
Exactly.
So who knows what and stuff like that is not only confused by who actually knew who, but again, people having forgotten stuff because of whatever made them forget stuff.
Exactly. So I'm just still trying to figure out what's going on. And they are. Everyone's trying to figure out what's going on. Nobody knows.
The whole continuity thing at DC is such a mess. It is disgusting.
It really is. And you've been pointing it out to me, and I've seen things. And I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how they're, if nobody's communicating, if it's bad editorial. I don't know what's going on.
Well, I think the problem is they don't have the equivalent of like a television series Bible for the DC universe. And even if they did, nobody's reading it. And because they don't have that kind of stuff, after they've done a few of these things like Flashpoint, like Rebirth, like switching out the Superman and such, the continuity has been retooled enough times that nobody's really sure what it is, so they assume it's whatever they want it to be.
Yeah, very true. And that kind of ties into Doomsday Clock number 10.
Yeah.
With a continuity, and now you can kind of play a little bit fast and loose with it.
Oh, they've been playing fast and loose with it since, well, forever.
Yeah, and now they have an explanation with that book.
They've had a few other explanations. Hypertime was a good one, too. Things aren't always consistent. And Hypertime, that was from Zero Hour, maybe?
Oh, okay. I didn't pick up that omnibus. I was thinking about it and debating it. I might still go back and pick it up.
Or was that from Kingdom Come, the sequel event after it or whatever?
Ah, okay.
I forget.
One of the two.
One of the two. Maybe a third. I could. They've had so many of these crises and stuff. It happens.
Exactly.
I'm sure a quick Wikipedia lookup on Hypertime would tell us where it originated.
And I remember that they talked about crisis-type stuff in the first issue of this book, but it's very loosely used here. This doesn't seem like a big, impactful thing that's going on in this book.
No, but I think it ties into big, impactful things, because this issue picks up after something had just happened in the Gem World that retooled the Gem World.
Okay.
And the implication is it is feeling the repercussions of the cosmic crisis event type stuff that we've had in the DC universe and some of the stuff happening with the various gems of the Gem World.
And it's spilling over, which is why they're upset and which is why they're, you know, basically taking it out on the Young Justice team.
Yeah, I think that they're ramping up for another kind of major cosmic level crisis.
I feel that too. And just hearing news and stuff that's happened, we've been reading Justice League, and you know, even Scott Snyder said, you know, after issue 25 of Justice League, he's like, consider every issue an event. So I'm like, huh, that means something big is happening.
Yeah, but if everything's an event, nothing's an event.
It's true. How much time do we have left in that Justice League book? That's the question.
I don't know. I did feel, though, that while Bendis was writing this issue, he might have wondered how much time he had left in this arc.
Because he stuffed a lot of stuff in here.
Well, we finally get some stuff on Teen Lantern, like her name, her code name, her, you know, one-sentence backstory or whatever.
Yep.
Nice to finally get it. It felt like some of the stuff we might have actually gotten in the solicit for the original series or something, or maybe an interview for it. But for it to come out as thump exposition, a little disappointing.
Yeah, it was just boom. And I was like, oh, that's who this person is. Because I've always seen her as a construct with, okay, she just exists and this is who it is. And it was nice to at least know who in the heck she is.
She seems cool. I want to see more of her.
I agree. I like her.
But I was hoping to dive a little more into her backstory than just get the thumbnail version.
Yeah, and he did a nice little job of explaining the, with a lot of dialogue there, the Gem World and how it works and how they have this. You know, each group has a special gem. A gem, what did they call it? Gem Prime.
Gem Prime.
Yeah, and that's the thing that they protect, and I don't know. And they went on and on and on.
What I love in that page is not only is there a ton of exposition, but there's the, if we could only get that Gem Prime from Opal or whatever. And then in one panel, Impulses go on. The next panel, he's back with the gem.
Yeah, he's just standing there. Huh? Here it is.
The only thing you need to know about Bart Allen is he is a do first, think later kind of a guy.
So that's his personality.
He was named Impulse originally by Batman pretty much as a warning. This kid just operates on impulse.
Yeah. So they're talking about it. Boom. He's off. He gets it, which creates all kinds of stuff inside of Jim World.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun stuff. There's some stuff where a lot of things are being teased. Some of the stuff that got resolved, like, again, what happened with Superboy and how did he get to the Jim World and stuff. I was hoping for a little bit more. I think there will still be a little bit more as stuff, pans out and the characters actually get a chance to have some quiet time and eventually actually talk about things. Not that they didn't do a ton of talking and exposition here. They did. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There hasn't been a ton of characterization in this book. So I think that maybe in the next arc, maybe we'll see some of that.
I think there's been characterization, but not in the quiet moment kind of have the characters interact and rebuild their relationship kind of way.
That's what's been missing. Yes, that I think that it feels like they're headed that way, depending on where they end up. I'll say that with what we have going on in here, where they end up, we can actually see maybe them interacting a little bit more and redeveloping those, kinships and stuff, and actually seeing a little bit more on. I want to see Connor and his life with that lady.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I want to see a little bit more clarity on the backstory in this continuity of kind of the original Young Justice kids. I mean, Impulse, Tim, Connor, and Cassie, it almost felt like they kind of, in some respects, couldn't exist in the current DC universe, although obviously Tim did, and so did the others at one point. But it's just, who remembers what and why, and when do they get back to Earth? What happens with Spoiler and a few of the other characters?
Yeah, because I need to know that, because I start getting, I'm like, what's going on when this person remembers this and this person knows nothing and another person remember parts of things? So that's the part that it gets a little bit, okay, this is weird. Explain to me why this is going on.
Yeah, and this is something where just a couple of footnotes would have given a little bit of help of, oh, that's where Superboy, was last seen or whatever.
Yeah, so it's not a total flop or anything, but there's just some misses in here.
Yeah, some misses, and I think part of it is there was a huge need for exposition, but also pulling this particular group of characters back together, given the current state of the DC universe, not easy, and you've got to jump through a couple of hoops to do it. And Bendis has been doing that gracefully, but there's still some unanswered questions.
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, still some unanswered questions, and I will say there are some nice teases which are going to keep you engaged to the point where you want to come back. And this was not decompressed, which Bendis does decompression so much. It was actually a lot of information in this book.
Yeah, I think there was a ton more story and stuff than we get in a lot of things. And I loved how this kind of closed off this arc, but definitely kicked off the next. And I'm looking forward to the whole bit with them lost in the multiverse, because, I mean, I like the multiverse.
Yeah, I would agree. And this is team is growing on me. I still like Teen Titans a tiny bit more. I don't know why. but this team is getting up there with them for me. So they've grown on me, Young Justice.
It's funny because I consider this to be more iconic Teen Titans than the current Teen Titans.
Yeah, I think it's just, what's his name? The character in Teen Titans.
Damian?
Damian. I just love Damian so much. I think that's what seals it for me. So, I mean, but this book, I like more of the characters than I do over there. It's just I'm such a big Damian fan that I love reading that book.
I would like to see Young Justice and the Teen Titans team up, clash, whatever you want to call it.
Oh, I would love that. That would be really cool. I think that would be a good read.
It'd be fun. Particularly if you could pull in the older Titans is getting called in to kind of referee or something.
Yeah, that'd be funny.
So I enjoyed this. It was a fun read. I think Bendis does a really good job with teenagers. I do want to see these characters, like I said, get back home just to see Connor interacting with Superman and, those kinds of things happen.
Yeah, I would agree. So I think this book is started off good, and I think it should be getting better from here. I think he just had a lot of action, and now he's got to do a lot of explaining, but in an interactive way that doesn't bore us to death. Don't give me the exposition dump.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm looking forward to a lot more of this. I think it's got a solid footing and looking to see where it goes. I enjoyed this quite a bit. There were some frustrations, like I said, but it was a good read. And this is a title that I'm, frankly, a bit more excited about than frankly, a lot of the rest of the DC universe.
Yeah, I can see that because it's also a little bit lighter. It's not dark and depressing. It's it's a lot of fun to read. It's a fun title. It seems like DC's doing a better job with their more younger skewed books, you know, books skewed to the younger reader, to the Teen Titans, Young Justice, Naomi. All those books seem to be doing a little bit better than, you know, the Batmans right now, which is kind of sad. Aquaman, Nightwing.
If you take Teen Titans out of the mix, just about all the ones that are featuring the younger characters are Bendis books.
Yeah, so Bendis is doing a good job. It's true.
Even if he's not writing them directly, when you think of Wonder Twins and Dial H, it's at least under the Wonder Comics umbrella that he's kind of shepherding.
So I would say a saving grace for DC right now with this conundrum that they've been in, or this slump, is hiring Bendis, because he's really keeping this ship afloat for me.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to go with a solid B on this. I thought it was a lot of fun and worth people's time.
Yeah, I liked it just slightly less of you, but not much. I was a B-. I thought it was good. I'm excited because the team is growing on me, and I want to see some more of these mysteries. I got to know what's in the box.
Yeah. I mean, I want to know what's in the box. I want to have another adventure with them in the multiverse. That seems like fun. But man, I do want to see these characters get back to their lives, to their supporting cast, and see, you know, how does Teen Lantern interact with a Green Lantern? How does Impulse interact with one of the Flashes or something? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, that'll be really cool.
Tons of opportunities. Tons.
Yes, there is.
Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
We shall.
This is Incredible Hulk Last Call number 1. Now, this is part of Marvel's 80 years anniversary stuff, and they're getting some of their old creative teams back together for some one-shots. This had Peter David and Dale Keown, and, I mean, great creative team for the Hulk, I would say. Certainly Peter David had probably the longest run ever on the Hulk. I'm not sure if anyone else has had more, but I honestly don't know. He was there for like 12 years.
Yeah, I think he had the longest run, and it was an amazing run.
Certainly the longest run I've read.
Yeah, me too. I read it all.
I don't think this was some of Dale Keown's best art, but I'm wondering if some of that was the four different inkers on top of him.
That's what I was wondering too, because Dale Keown, I was thinking, he's a better artist than this. And then I was like you, I did see all those inkers. I'm like, I don't know why that happened, but some of the panels do look a little bit different, you know, from page to page.
Yeah, I think part of it is he certainly was a better artist than this, and I have no reason to think that he's not currently still a better artist than this. But I also don't remember the last thing I read of his.
Yeah, me neither. I can't remember him being on a book in recent memory. I mean, the best thing I remember him from is the Hulk back then, mm-hmm. in the days, in the 90s. So I can't remember anything recent. So if he's been out of the industry for a while, he did a heck of a job coming back.
Yeah, I'm not sure what his current status is. Maybe he's just a little rusty, or maybe he'd retired. I don't know. Either way, he does good art here, but it's not one of those where I think it's the pinnacle of his career.
I agree. And Peter David has been exercising his skills a little bit more.
Yes. And Peter David is, I think, a surprisingly underrated writer, given just how much he's done. I mean, he was the one who originated Young Justice. He had a like we said, a 12-year run on the Hulk, long run on Aquaman. He's done some creator-owned stuff, Soul Searchers and Company and things like that. Done a lot of Star Trek, both in comics and some of the novels. Matter of fact, he had his own branch of the franchise there.
Oh, yeah. So, he even did a long run on the X-Factor, I think it was.
Yeah, actually, X-Factor was one of his other signature ones. You're right. I'd forgotten about that. He's got so much, it's hard to remember it all.
Exactly.
And what I liked about this issue is during his run on the Hulk, he really rethought the character. He kept it true to what it was, but introduced kind of that multiple personality aspect and the evolving nature of the Hulk that was there really from day one, when the character had originally started as the Gray Hulk, turned into the Green one, I don't know, 7 issues later or something.
Yeah.
So it's not that he was revamping the character, but he was bringing back some of the early stuff and really taking it to a whole nother level.
I would agree with that. He really got into the split in the personality and how the character was affected, and it was just amazing. And this book was also, to me, pretty amazing, just because it felt like, you know, I've been reading, not to bring up a bad topic, but, you know, Tom King, Batman, and he's been dealing a lot with, in some of his books, PTSD stuff. And this felt like it wasn't that. It's not a PTSD issue, but it felt like that type of riff, but done in a better way.
I don't know how Bruce Banner could have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah,
I don't
he just
know
has
when
stress
he gets,
disorder.
I was going to say, where's that post part? I think he'd love that.
It's true. Yeah, this is a guy dealing with it right now.
What I found interesting in this was there was an aspect of walking down memory lane, and while there are a lot of flashbacks and stuff, it didn't feel like just a clip show.
No, it did not.
And the whole concept of the Hulk is Bruce Banner's kind of a personification of his will to live.
Yeah, that was what I really liked in here, just seeing the dual personality. And Last Call, it's so appropriate because it's Last Call for this creative team. It's the Last Call with Bruce's call to a hotline when he's having problems. And then, but at the same time, you see the struggle with being the Hulk, the struggle with having the Hulk within you, but then also the benefits and the great things that come about from having the Hulk in you. You know, it's a dual nature, and there's good, there's bad. It's not one or the other.
Yeah, and I thought that was dealt with, that while there's some major downsides to being this rampaging Hulk at times, it's not all downsides.
Which I really liked. I thought that was so cool how he did that.
It was a little coincidental that he just happened to call somebody who had a tie to somebody else he knew, that kind of a thing, but it's fine, I'll give it to him.
Yeah, that was kind of funny, but yeah, coincidental. But yeah, it was really cool. He made the phone call, and it was done in a nice way. They had some action scenes in here. They had the clips looking back at the past, and then you see him dealing with anger, and then you see him dealing with anger when he takes on a character. So you see two different things.
Well, the one thing I didn't see here, and it was just a line or two that I'd like to see Peter David explore, because I think it'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
But again, Hulk is Banner's personification of his will to live, the whole fight or flight, and the Hulk is fight.
Yes.
What on earth would the flight aspect look like?
Very true, because I mean, that's...
Imagine if Banner / the Hulk is somewhere where you simply can't fight your way out of it. The planet's exploding out from under you, whatever. You've literally got to run.
Exactly. That would be something that I would love to see.
I mean, it wouldn't be like a super speedster, but it'd be some kind of really bizarre gamma-powered parkour character, maybe.
Exactly. Making those super jumps for miles.
Yeah, you jump over this, you plow through that, whatever.
Get the heck out of Dodge.
Yeah.
And this book was so different than the current Immortal Hulk that we're reading, which is more of a horror comic. And I'm loving Immortal Hulk, but this also brings me back to my favorite era of the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just kind of like a nice reminder of, oh yeah, I remember that. That was really cool.
Yeah, I think it was, if you haven't read Peter David's stuff and you like this, definitely check out his run on the Hulk. There's tons of it, and it's all worth reading. Different parts for different reasons. And this was, I thought, a really good, basically, a character piece on the Hulk. You get to know who he is, who Banner is, and the struggle.
Oh yeah, and actually on that collection, Peter David, I heard some whispers over at the Collected Comics, you know, library thing. They have a podcast and they also have a Slack channel.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking over there that there's going to be several omnibus coming out collecting Peter David's run.
Oh, cool. That's great stuff.
Yeah. So I will definitely be buying that because my favorite character and one of my favorite runs, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm on board for as many as they want to print.
I thought Peter David, he really knows how to do a good character piece. This was a great example of that. There was plenty of action. It showed a love and knowledge of the character that I'm not the least bit surprised he has. And there were also a couple of Easter eggs here and there. The choice of the would-be assassin I thought was cool.
That was cool. It was just such a satisfying read, even though it was a one-shot.
Yeah, yeah. This was longer than normal, like time and a half, maybe a little longer. So the $4.99 price tag wasn't completely outrageous, but it's a little higher than I think comics ought to be these days. But it's as much as they are these days, so, you know, it's that.
Yeah, the one thing I was kind of happy with is sometimes when you get these $4.99 issues, they give you like the main story, which is normal, and then that little tack on, and they didn't do that here. You get all Peter David front to back.
Yeah, yeah. You had the creative team the entire time, and they didn't feel rushed for time or padding out a regular length story.
Exactly. And like I said, I was surprised in how much I enjoyed it, because usually, typically one-shots are hit or miss for me, and usually they're okay. And this one, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Definitely something I recommend. I recommend, like I said, his entire run. It's great stuff, and probably one of the iconic, not probably, I think it is one of the iconic runs on the Hulk character. I went with a solid B+ on this and think people should check it out.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I am the Hulk aficionado. Well, he's my guy. And Peter David, he's my guy when it comes to the Hulk. So I loved it, loved it, loved it. I almost went with an A, gave it an A- because the art was a little bit off for me.
Yeah, the art, I was frankly a little surprised, because I remember, like I said, Dale Keown being just an outstanding artist. This was good, but not to the levels he had done, I think, back in the day when he was on the book on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the only thing that kept it from hitting the A category for me. So I went with an A-. I love it. I think everyone should read this thing.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Shall we move on to our other book?
Sounds good.
This is The Walking Dead number 192. Now, we may go a little bit more into spoilers here because something big happened last issue.
Yeah, I don't know how you can talk about this without spoiling stuff.
Yeah, at the end of last issue, Rick Grimes was shot.
Yes, dead center in the chest, too.
And it did not look good for him.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of this issue, it looks even less good for him.
Yeah, a lot less good.
I think it's, what, another two or three shots less good?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Boom, boom, boom. I'm like, okay, that happened.
And this is one where, I mean, Kirkman knows what he's doing. He knows how to kind of manipulate the audience well. I think that's one of his really great skills as a writer. He knows how to evoke reactions out of us. And he did that a number of times throughout this issue, not only with Rick getting shot again, but what happens with that, he does a couple of twists and turns. I thought there was a moment near the end that was just really well done. There was some action of sorts in this. There was some major kind of plot movement and stuff. This is one of those, there's a before and after this issue in this continuity, period.
Yes, yes, I agree.
And having that kind of clear demarcation and having so much happen here, have a couple of other characters really step up and deliver some really great scenes, I thought this was just a fantastic issue.
It was fantastic, even though, you know, it's kind of light on dialogue, but you didn't need the dialogue because the scenes convey what he wanted you to feel, and I felt it. So it was really kind of cool. And this is a real gut punch because, you know, Kirkman writes at the end, this really was kind of a Rick Grimes story, but he knew that Rick Grimes was not going to make it maybe one day, and or wasn't going to make it. And so he's like, the world continues, but so this one's a big gut punch because he has been the center of this book for 192 issues. That's insane.
Yeah, he has been the focal character. Even on issues where we may not have seen him front and center, everything was kind of revolving around his group of survivors, the impact they've had and stuff. And really, the furthest we've ever gotten away from kind of his story was the one-shot they did over at, what's the online,
I know what you're talking about when,
Blanket on the name of the site.
I know what you're talking about, though, but, and he had, the guy who writes Saga.
Yeah.
Wrote an issue.
Yeah, Brian K. Vaughan, the place that does, Private Eyes, that does, Panel Syndicate.
Panel Syndicate, yes. All right,
come to me eventually. that one-shot they did was the furthest we've gotten away from kind of the core story. And again, here, things change. There was one or two things that happened that, you know, I hadn't expected it. But if I'd given it any thought, it's like, this has to happen. But again, Kirkman has got such a gift for setting things up to where things happen logically, even if you don't see them coming when you really should have.
Yes.
There's a master of misdirection almost there without cheating or lying to us.
I would agree. And the way he set this up, which, you know, it's not ingenious, but the way he did it was nice in that in the last issue, you know, you see the shot and everyone's like, oh, my gosh, you know, and that was, I guess, you know, big speculation thing. And then issue 192, he just drove home the point. Everything he did here was very masterfully done. But and it's just the way he does it. It's the way he sets you up and the way he makes you feel and the way that he shows you through the art. His artist does that in collaboration where words don't need to be said. I just love the ending of this book when they want to take care of the afterwards, you know, and take him to Alexandria. And can we tag along? You know, can I tag along?
The two-page splash there, incredibly effective. I thought that was brilliant. I almost think they should have ended the issue right there.
Me too. I was surprised that they didn't because that would have been a perfect place. And then there was the next thing, which I was like, okay. And then there's the other one, which was good. But that one would have been the perfect one to end on.
I almost would have taken the final two-page splash as maybe a wraparound cover for the next issue.
Yep.
And started with the two pages right before that, after the first of the two-page splashes, where I would have ended this issue.
That would have actually made a lot of sense, and that probably would have looked a little bit better. Not that this looked bad, but yeah, that would have made more sense, because that two-page spread, or the splash page, was the perfect way to end this issue. And then if he would have wrote up his narrative piece, which at the end he wrote a page, or no, not yeah, actually a page and a half of information about building up to this.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just, this was a really impactful issue, and I'm going to miss Rick. Rick held this book together for me. Now, you know, other characters, of course, will step up. But same thing with the TV show. You know, they took Rick off the TV show, not without actually showing him being killed or anything. And the show's not as good.
Yeah, I think, though, this was one where we couldn't expect everyone to survive forever. It's just not that kind of a world. And this didn't feel like a bad death for Rick Grimes. And again, I think what we're going to get next is really almost a celebration of him and the impact he's had on so many people.
Yeah, that'll definitely be the next issue, you know, seeing him and remembering him. So
I mean, think it's more than just the next issue. I think that's something that maybe not be the full plot for the next arc or whatever, but is going to keep coming up.
Yeah, because he was the focal point of this book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, it feels so weird. Here we are reading this, and I remember when I read 191, and then they were talking about the speculation on 192. I was like, man, we probably should review that.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big book. I'm like, wow, this kind of stuff doesn't happen very often where it's a central character.
I'm curious what he's planning to do for issue 200, because I'm sure he's got something big planned, and this is going to be hard to top.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I'm curious to see who really steps up into that leadership position. I mean, there's characters here that, you know, you can pick and choose. Some people think some think the other. But I want to see how the dynamic changes, and I do want to see what happens in 200. I'm excited for that.
Yeah. I think the other thing that really needs to be mentioned here is the art team did just a fantastic job, because there were a lot of places where there wasn't a word of dialogue on a lot of these pages. Yet a lot was conveyed, a lot of story was told, the feeling was put out there very well, and that's something that it almost doesn't matter how brilliantly Kirkman could have written the script, some artists could pull this off, some couldn't. These guys did a great job.
They did an amazing job, and I agree with you. Kudos to them. And there was a big change on the art that I guess there was a different inker on here than the main artist. The anchor's been Stefano, I think it's Godino, and this will be the last issue that he inks, I guess I was reading. So Charlie Adler will start inking his own work again.
Yeah, and this guy had been inking since issue 115, I think?
Yeah, 115. So he's been inking for quite a while.
So I think it says they brought him on board when they were doing the bi-weekly stuff.
Yep, when they were doing the double shipping, I guess you could call it, but yeah, bi-weekly.
Yeah. Well, and for a title that at one point was having a hard time getting issues out early on, around early, you know, issue 40, thereabouts, for them to have gotten to where they are not only coming out by like clockwork, but at times able to get, you know, two issues a month out without sacrificing quality, this is getting to a fairly well-oiled machine that is really one of the longer narratives in comics these days.
Very much so. And I'm honestly in awe of like Charlie Adler on this thing, because he's been drawing this thing since, I guess, the seventh issue.
Yeah.
And I'm like, they keep coming out. I'm like, he needs to take a vacation. Maybe he draws really quick. I guess he must draw super fast, because I'm like, this guy never takes a break. He just continual. It's like clockwork, comes out. Boom, boom, boom. Here it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing.
Well, I'm curious how he manages to pace himself both to get the output and not to burn out.
That would be the thing for me. I would think after doing, you know, issue after issue for 10 years, I guess the money must be really good, but still you can burn out when the money's good. And he does not seem to have burned out, because like you said, the art is very impactful and very, you can feel the emotion in the art.
10 years, I think it's been like 15, but I mean,
15 years.
it's outstanding. It's unbelievable to have that kind of solid creative team for that long and showing no signs of slowing down at all.
Yeah, it's just nuts. So my hat's off to everyone who works on this book, and this was a great issue.
Yeah, I think it was. It's going to go down as one of the pivotal issues of the series, and I think really beyond the first issue, I'd be hard pressed to name too many others that will have the same impact that this does. There are a few when they did that jump forward in time, being one of them. Maybe something around the Governor saga and stuff early on.
Probably. But this is probably going to be the biggest, I think.
Yeah, this is going to be one of the ones where, you know, 10, 20 years from now, you look at the price guide and it's, oh, why did that one jump up? Oh, you know.
That's because that happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And what's nice is this isn't something that he's going to backpedal on.
No, he will not. It happened. It's done. And you know what's weird is, like, you know, Kirkman, he really spills out his guts in these letter columns. You know, he writes up a little article in every issue. And, you know, when characters die, it really impacts him. Sometimes I think it impacts him more than the reader.
I think so. I think this is a definite passion project for him. I don't see how he could have done it this long without it being that way. And he's gotten, obviously, invested in the characters, which is good, because if he's not, why would we?
Yep.
And he's not... I mean, there was a character on Person of Interest, the TV show, that got killed off. And the reason they did that is, well, it was a fan favorite character, and we wanted to get a reaction out of people. And I'm like, that's a horrible reason to kill a character off.
Just to get a reaction, yeah. That's really bad.
If that's what you have to do, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, there's a problem then.
And this is something that there are other ways Kirkman could have gone here and gotten much the same sort of reaction. You know, if Rick had gone into a coma or something like that, or I don't know. I'm glad he didn't go that way. I think he doesn't commit halfway. He goes all the way on stuff. And that's, I think, one of the things that really sets this title apart from most of the other stuff that's on the shelf these days.
Yeah. And he's a very honest writer in that he didn't do this as a gimmick. And he talks about that, how he knew this was a story about Rick at the beginning. And he knew that Rick would not be there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And he had planned this from the beginning. It wasn't just a gimmick that he came out with. And, you know, he's like, with every passing year, with every passing month, with every passing week, as he's getting up to this, it got harder and harder because he knew it was coming.
Well, it makes me wonder if Rick coming out of the coma in the first issue, starting the story, what's the end of the story?
That's what I want to know, because you would think there's going to be an end at some time. You know, Kirkman's going to want to retire. Who knows? I mean, every great story has an end, a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, yeah, what is the end game for this? I don't know.
I'm sure he's got something in mind. I hope it's satisfying, and I hope it's a ways out.
Me too, because I'm still not done with The Walking Dead, so I'm loving it. It's still on TV. He's still making a lot of money. Let's keep it going.
There's no reason for this not to hit issue 300.
I would agree, yeah. And it's doing it in a fashion where... Everyone's entertained. I mean, the sales are off the charts. It does better in trades than it does in singles, and the singles are in and out, you know, usually a top 10 book.
Top 20 at least. It's
top 20,
up at it's one of the best-selling ongoing titles. Most of the other stuff that beats it out are either number ones or, you know, miniseries or events or something.
Yeah.
He's certainly doing a great job on this, and I'm looking forward to seeing where he goes and if he's got a big build-up for issue 200 coming up.
Me too. I'm excited.
Solid A on this. I think, again, that ending could have been a little bit tighter. I don't think there was anything wrong with what it had. But, man, if it had stopped just on that two-page splash, it would have had such a clean ending for the issue.
I agree with you on the rating. I went with an A on this. I thought this was great. And I was so happy with the books this week because we had it just really great reads all around. And that doesn't always happen. So this was a great way to end with a great book for this week.
Absolutely.
So anyways, but I am kind of sad. I'm sad, but I'm excited because I want to see how he keeps me hooked. And I know Kirkman well. He's a great writer.
He will. There are times where he is so manipulative of the audience, which is his job. He should be, you know. But there are times I do feel like I've been toyed with, because we have been.
Exactly.
You know, there are ways he could have done this issue that wouldn't have gotten to the heartstrings or whatever, but that's not the kind of writer he is or should be. Anyone who could do this kind of a story and have it fall flat would be disappointing.
Yeah, I actually would have been, I don't want to say upset, but I would have been disappointed if 191 would have ended with the shot and 192, you know, somehow he survived. That would have been disappointing to me.
Yeah, and that's something that I would have been shocked if Kirkman had done.
Yeah. So he definitely did it the right way. Now, unrelated to our reviews, I did have a question for you. Some stuff that came up on the Slack channel, but I just wanted you to clarify it for us and how this all played out. The numbers, and they were talking about DC and the numbers, and I know you're the expert with numbers with your Mayo report. This 25-cent villains issue, what happened there, and why is everyone talking about it?
Okay, what happened was, at one point, those sorts of promotional things that are sold basically at or under cost were indeed included in the rankings and stuff like that. That was like years and years and years ago. After a couple of these things that were promotional things through a loot crate or something like that, they said, you know what, it's a different kind of a sale. It's not included there, which is, I think, the right choice. But what happened here seems to be that the sales were not included in the rankings, but seem to have been included in the overall market share.
Okay. Now,
if you've looked at my articles and stuff on CBR, I've got the market share and then I've got the breakdown of the top 300 comics and top 300 trades. Those breakdowns I'm calculating based on the data I've got. The market share is coming straight from Diamond. It includes comics, trades, magazines, some other stuff. And it's a little loose as to exactly what's in there.
Okay.
And I tend to ignore them because I can't justify those numbers. I can't categorically say they absolutely did this or didn't. John Jackson Miller, who'd done a little bit more math on that side of it, this time around, indicates that the sales seem to have been included on the unit share. Obviously, the dollars at a quarter versus, you know, $3.99 were a negligible increase, which is why we see DC and Marvel almost neck and neck on units, but a pretty big gulf between them in terms of the market share on dollars.
Ah, okay. So that's what all the uproar is about, that they're including stuff that didn't used to be included.
Yeah. Well, it's not that's not right.
Okay.
Because they don't include it on the rankings in the top comics.
Okay, so not in the rankings, but just for the totals for the month.
Well, in the market share for the month.
Market share for the month, okay.
Because you got to be clear on that. They don't give totals, they don't give units, they don't give any of that stuff.
Okay.
Milton Greep, John Jackson Miller, myself, we're doing the number crunching behind the scenes to take the index value, get those to units, so we can do month-to-month comparisons.
Okay, that makes sense now. So... And then you can almost kind of do backwards math and kind of calculate and guesstimate what the real sales were and what the real dollars were, possibly.
Well, and certainly Milton and John Jackson Miller do, I think, a lot more of that kind of stuff because they're frankly tied into the industry much tighter than I am. And they've got bigger insights as to what's going on in some places that I don't.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, thank you, because I was curious. I heard everyone talking about this. I'm like, I thought these promotional things didn't count, but they don't count in the numbers that you share with us, but they do count in that large market share.
Apparently. And I don't know if anyone – it's hard to know for certain again, because unless you've got something that's such a big deal like the Year of the Villain and at such a low price, it's a little hard to figure out exactly how they got to that number, since that includes – all the comics, all the trades, and we only see the top 500 comics and trades in the top 10 magazines.
Yeah. So do you know what they estimated or guesstimated the 25-cent villain issue, how many of them they sold?
I do not. I believe what I was hearing on Slack was John Jackson Miller pegged it somewhere in the near a million mark, but I don't know that for certain.
That's a lot of them.
Honestly, I haven't had time to read his article because I spent the weekend crunching the numbers and doing mine.
Ah, so yours is coming out shortly.
Yeah, I've already got it up as we record this on the 11th on the comic book page website. It'll go up shortly on CBR.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, I'm looking forward to listening to it, so I always enjoy it.
Yeah, I try to get the numbers up as quickly as I can on my website. Not that I think we get tons of traffic there, and that's part of why I also do them on CBR, which has a much bigger audience and such.
Yeah, CBR, I hate the way that they changed their layout when I go to the website now. They changed it a little while back. It just makes it harder to find data, I think.
Yeah, I think CBR, Newsarama, those kinds of sites, they're more up on current web trends and what looks hot and cool and stuff like that, certainly than I am. And there are times where it gets a little busy, chaotic for my tastes.
Yeah, sometimes I go there and I'm like, oh man, they changed it and I can't find anything.
Bleeding Cool is over the top for me in that kind of respect.
Yeah.
It's just, it's too busy. It's sensory overload for me.
Yeah. Hey, now, did you hear about the other, kerfuffle that we had with Rob Liefeld recently?
Only bits and pieces. He thinks DC's on the decline and about to go under. And apparently he got off Twitter as a result.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because of like he was being so out there. He was using flame bait. He basically said DC's on the verge of collapse, and he's basically just kicking back and enjoying it, watching it happen. But he's talking about the Batman, the Damned, and with the Batwing and all that, the cancellation of the Second Coming, Vertigo going, Tom King being pulled off Batman ahead of time, and he's like, continuity stuff. So he's just like, DC's collapsing, and he's just like eating popcorn and enjoying the show.
He may have overstated stuff, but I'm not going to say he's totally wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's kind of like, I think what happened is there's people who went crazy and he basically took his Twitter down because they were, making threats and acting nuts. But I mean, a lot of what he's saying is kind of true. DC is kind of in flames, other than Bendis is doing a heck of a job over there. He's doing really good.
Well, you look at the number of titles they placed in the top 500 this time around. There wasn't tons compared to Marvel that's just printing everything they possibly can.
Yep.
One of the other comments on the Slack channel was how I think it was maybe Franklin was suggesting that Marvel just has a bigger library of characters.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not. Could go either way, honestly. DC's got another, decade or two of hardcore publishing of tons of material, when Marvel really wasn't doing as much going from Timely to the actual Marvel Universe in the 60s. But it doesn't matter how many characters they have, because you've got some characters like Batman that can support, half a dozen or a dozen titles, and you've got other characters that can't support a title at all, even with another half dozen characters with them.
Very true.
So the size of the library of characters is completely irrelevant. But I do think DC is not at a good spot right now, and they need to do something about it.
Yeah, and thing I say you'll notice, I mean, well, you already noticed. She noticed trends. It seems like it goes through ebbs and flows. It's very cyclical, the industry. DC was knocking it out of the park probably, a few years back, when Rebirth was first happening. And it seemed like Marvel was just horrible. That, everything they came out with was not good. And all the writers were leaving, and now it's kind of flip-flop. Now Marvel's, knocking out of the park in some respect, and DC's struggling. I think DC will come back. It's just, I think they got to get their footing under them as far as which way did they want to go and which writers did they want to push, because they have some good stuff. Snyder's been doing a decent job with Justice League. You have Venditti doing Hawkman, which is amazing. It's just some of the core books are not doing well. When your core books aren't doing well, and I'm talking about like Wonder Woman, Batman, and for me, like Aquaman was a core character for me, and the Green Lantern book, you mess up those, that's really DC proper.
Yeah, but you've got a couple of these characters that, again, there's the characters that can sustain multiple books, characters that can sustain a book, characters that can almost sustain a book and keep getting trotted back out there and stuff, and I put Hawkman certainly in that category, as I would Martian Manhunter, Firestorm. Aquaman's somewhere between that level of can't sustain a series and can sustain a series.
That's right there, yeah.
You know, and leaning a little more towards the can, but not always.
Yeah. I've just been sad with some of the ones that I was really loving. They seem like those are the ones that are taking the lumps right now.
I think really what DC needs to do is, while I certainly think a change of leadership in publisher level is not out of the question, I don't think it's where they need to focus. I really think they need to get somebody that is a strong creative lead, get another either chief creative officer or an actual editor in chief that's a bit more visible, a bit more vocal, and frankly, a better steward of the characters.
And that would help them immensely. Now, if you had to pick someone, who would you pick to do that job?
Man, that's a tough call. There's a couple of people that I think are certainly capable of it. Whether they'd be available, whether they'd be willing is another matter entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, depending on what they're currently doing and do they want to take that on.
Do they want to take it on and what's their feeling towards DC and stuff? I certainly think Geoff Johns did a very good job.
Yep.
Mark Waid has encyclopedic knowledge of the characters, a deep love for them, and is a terrific writer and editor.
Mark Waid would do an amazing job doing that, basically being that chief creative officer, and he would keep them all on track, I think.
I think so. I think they've had some people on the editorial side that were really solid and stuff, and underused and underappreciated. Mike Carlin comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So there's people out there that could do that, but I think that historically, when I look at the numbers that I've been crunching for the last, I don't know, 20 years or more, Marvel almost always winds up on top, often by a decent margin. So DC's out of the top two, the underdog. And I think DC's got solid characters. They just don't often know how to use them. They don't have a consistent direction. And to me, it comes down to a failure in leadership and creative vision.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I think they have the character library where they could really... It's strong. My gut, I know that I'm not trying to offend anyone. I think Marvel's a little bit stronger, but I think DC is very strong, but it really comes down to the leadership and who's driving the ship. And right now I feel like it's all over. Everyone's steering a wheel a different way and it's just getting torn apart.
Well, yeah, they're zigzagging and they're flip-flopping. I mean, are they bringing Wally West back? Or are they not? Are they going to bring the Justice Society and the Legion back? Or are they not? You know, let's go this way. Oh, let's go that way, you know?
Yeah. Is Wally Wally or is he not?
Do we need two Wallys? Do we need two Superboys? What's going on with all of that? I mean, that's just some stuff. And then we're 10 issues into Doomsday Clock, and I'm still really waiting for, I don't want to say for the story to start, but for some action.
Yeah. It was like, number 10 was kind of cool, this concept they came out with, but I'm hoping it reads better as a trade because I'm still kind of just, all right, it's good. It's okay, but...
It was good, but it wasn't good for a 10th issue of a 12-issue series.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly where I am. I'm like, okay, something has to happen from this, and I guess they only have 2 issues to do it.
I mean, you go look back at Crisis on Infinite Earths and look at where it was 10 issues in.
Yeah, so much had happened. And it felt like this was just dragging its feet and not doing anything. It wasn't going anywhere, and then delay upon delay, and then they said it wasn't the artist. I'm like, well, is Geoff Johns not being able to... What's going on?
I was seeing some delays in Shazam coming up and a few other books.
Yeah, is there something going on with him? Is he just too busy? I don't know.
I don't know, but there's an aspect of get the books out on time, and there's an aspect of, frankly, tell better stories.
Yeah. The hardest thing, and this is something that I found out... Okay, I have a team. We do sales and service with the business that I have. And sometimes the inclination is to take my best salesperson and make them the sales team manager, you know, put them in charge of the salespeople. And that's really sometimes not the best thing. The best thing that person does is sales, not necessarily managing and leading.
Yeah.
So I know it's a different skill set. So I wonder if maybe Geoff Johns, if his best thing is not doing maybe some other things and really just focusing on creating great books, which he seems to be amazing at.
But that may be the key difference between an editor-in-chief who can do that kind of managerial sort of a thing as well as editing, and the chief creative officer, who can be more of that coach or whatever that works with the people who are trafficking the books, managing the people and stuff, and the chief creative officer is managing the story and the characters.
That I could see him doing. I can see him being the creative brain, just coaching people along the way, but not having to do that managerial aspect, not having to be, this is what's going to happen, you know, more of like, hey, here's something cool you try doing.
I mean, I would certainly, if I were kind of running DC or Marvel, I would structure the editorial stuff to where you have different people with different kinds of responsibilities that are operating as a team to co-edit the books.
You've that would got be cool.
Somebody who's just an insanely good project manager is on top of where pages are at, what's got to be done, what's holding a book up, and can get the trains running on time.
Yep.
You've got somebody else that's just a continuity buff and can keep all of this stuff straight. No, wait, we're doing a similar story over there, so let's not do this here. It's going to conflict with this, or what about that? And not necessarily saying, oh, you can't do this, but making sure it's done for a reason and you don't wind up with two stories happening concurrently that are either directly contradictory or so overlapping that they're confusing is wait, they're separate stories?
Exactly.
Have somebody else that's just insanely good at proofreading, catching the typos, do they get the character voices right, those sorts of things. You know, there are different skill sets, and you don't need to, you shouldn't expect every editor to have every one of those.
Exactly. You almost need an editing team, like team editing for this group, like the Spider-Man group or the Batman group of families, and they work in conjunction with each other.
Yeah, and I'd have some people that specialize in relationship management.
Yeah.
How do you get the best out of a creator? You may need to go to somebody else and figure out, well, what do we need to be doing, what's going on? But somebody who can act as, I don't say the intermediary between the production person saying, you're late, and the artist saying, well, I need more time.
Yeah.
Or the writer.
When someone's in a slump, really being able to coach them and talk to them and say, how can we help you out? What do you need? Would you like to partner with this? Can we do this? And or if it's a writing block, you know, hey, have you thought about this? And sending someone in, one of your best, to give them a tip or two.
That'd be kind of cool. You may have somebody who's great at bouncing ideas off of. It's not, well, do this, but, oh, have you thought about this or what about that? And can ask the right questions to get the right story out of somebody.
See, John, it sounds like you should be running DC.
If they want to offer me the job, I'll certainly talk to them.
All right, I'm putting your name in the hat.
Don't know that I'd want to move necessarily, but you know, it'd be a job I would consider it for.
Hey, that'd be awesome.
It would actually be insane. Certainly would be fun though.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's not something you can turn around overnight, and I think you'd need to set it up to where you let the current storylines kind of play out over a few months to get to a graceful ending. You have some arcs that transition stuff, and then you have arcs in the direction you actually want to go.
Yeah, and honestly, someone with your... it seems like the way that you're wired, you are a very organized person. I think you get the ship righted.
I think so. I'd need some people with me that were better storytellers than I am.
Oh, yeah. Hey, don't worry. You got Jeff Johns and Bendis, so you can hire some more talent.
You need it on the editorial staff, though.
That's true. You need a Mark Waid.
Oh, you need somebody keeping an eye on the stuff to where you don't wind up like they did before. I think it was the New 52 where they realized that, or was it the New 52 or Rebirth? One of them. Hal Jordan was an intergalactic space criminal or whatever, and this had gone wrong over there, and they're like, you guys took your eye off the ball.
Exactly.
So, something's got to change.
Something does, and I am hoping it happens sooner rather than later.
I don't know. I'm finding a lot more free time now that I'm not reading as much.
One of the benefits of DC's continuity. John
Absolutely.
Has more time.
Absolutely.
So you always make me laugh.
Well, I try. It's either that or cry at what they're doing on some of this stuff, because it's just not good.
Exactly.
All right, so as we record this, we just had the last preview spotlight stuff. That actually goes up tomorrow as we record this. Great turnout this time around. Thanks, everybody. Drew had put a challenge down on Slack of trying to get 10% of the number of people for, you know, episode 140, so trying to get 14 people, and we did get that. So again, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Drew, for throwing the challenge down and encouraging people to do it. The next preview spotlight deadline is going to be Saturday morning, July 6th. Now, that's right after July 4th weekend, or July 4th Thursday, so I guess it is July 4th weekend if you're taking the Friday off, too. If you can get the clips in early, that would be appreciated, as always. Hopefully, there's a little extra time for you to get some clips in. The more people, the better. It's just, it's a lot of fun hearing everybody's picks.
Definitely, I agree.
We're not going to do a teleconference in July because that would be right at Comic-Con and such, and people are either going to be busy at Comic-Con or figuring out what the hell happened at Comic-Con. So, you know.
True.
We'll do it in August, probably the 10th. I'll announce that for sure when we get closer. That'll be a Saturday, 7 p.m. Central Time, like always.
Awesome.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
That pretty much does it.
Cool.
Join us next time as we discuss Hawkman number 13 from DC, True Believers Spider-Man Morbius number 1 from Marvel, and Sonata number 1 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.